Chapter 42. The Spellmonger's Trial. The greatest day of the Seven Dwarf Fair was midweek, when the Spellmonger's Trial was held. The event had drawn the talented of every stripe to Seven Dwarf in an attempt to compete in the mysterious contest. At least I had taken great pains for it to remain mysterious. I didn't have a joust to attract people, so I tried to create a magical equivalent. The Spellmonger's Trial was the result. The winner got a witch stone, with some reservations, and that had attracted plenty of ambitious wizards to my vale. Over 200 magi of various sorts had registered to participate in the unknown contest, and were milling around the mid-morning sunshine on the far open end of the Seven Dwarf Commons as I prepared to address them. I was almost as excited as they were. Since the Spellmonger's Trial was the only way for most of them to secure a stone, short of fighting goblins, the competition was going to be pretty fierce. That's how I wanted it. A witch stone is not something to get by luck. To be appreciated, I found, it had to be earned. So I had devised a method of sorting out the clever, wise, and talented from the merely lucky. We started that morning on the Commons, where I addressed everyone after ringing that damned bell again. I explained the rules. Only low magi were eligible. You still have to swear my oath, and I would tolerate no taking of each other's lives. I wanted a healthy completion, not a bloodbath. There had been speculation about the specifics of the event since I'd announced it to everyone at the coronation. Rumors had flown like rabid bats, and I'd enjoyed listening to the various possibilities. I'd even gotten some ideas. But today was the day. And now was the time. More than 200 sets of eyes watched me intently as I finally revealed the object of the trial. A few nights ago, I chanced to stroll across the peak of Matten's Helm, I said, gesturing to the tall, steep hill in the distance. I was enjoying the evening and smoking a pipe with my new Alka friends, I said, which I figured should impress everyone. I suppose in my reverie I laid it down on a stone and forgot about it. I would dearly love to have it back, but it is such a long way from here. I have scried the site, and am sure it is still there, but it may be guarded, I said mischievously. I watched the crowd, enjoying the suspense. We had spent the last week before the fair preparing, and now I got to reveal it. Your trial is simple. The mage who lays my pipe in my hands first will win the stone. There was a great stir of excitement in the crowd. Many had figured combat of some sort would figure into the contest. There was a war on, after all, and there were dozens of war magi competing for the stone. But this was merely fetching the mage lord's pipe. That made a number of war magi grumble, and a number of foot wizards smile. Neither had any idea what challenge they'd face, but the moment I rang the bell, over 200 magi sprinted out of the commons toward the peak, under the gaze of the cheering crowd. That bit of theatre done, I retired to my pavilion on the commons. The other high magi present joined me for this event, curious as to how it would play out. I'd encouraged it, as it allowed me to appeal to them as judges, should there be some dispute in the contest. Since many of them had helped me with different aspects of the trial, they seemed the perfect arbiters. We gathered around a trestle under my canopy and enjoyed the hospitality of the spell warden, whose servants, Bannermore had servants, brought us food, drink, and smoking herbs, as we requested, to refresh us during our discussion. I was impressed with my spell warden. He had not only managed to keep his private business afloat during the siege, he had been well prepared when the first wagons rolled through the dyke tower to the fair. It was fascinating watching the man who had been footsore and threadbare less than a year ago confidently command a legion of functionaries. While he frequently consulted with the aides he had hired, he had yet to look ruffled or uncertain in the face of minor crisis. That kept him out of a lot of the interesting debate that evolved around the day's event, but as he was one of its officials, the novelty of the occasion had faded. Not so the other high magi. Sarakim and Planus thought the trial was great sport. Mavone, who had arrived from Wenchar a few days before on his way to the west, and battle, thought it was boring and frivolous. And Master Cormoran and Pentandro were both intrigued with the concept, but generally uninterested in the result. They were more interested in discussing some of the amazing things I'd missed at their lectures, which I really wanted to pay attention to, but I hadn't found the time to attend. That's the problem with being an administrator. You miss all the good stuff. It didn't take us long to get around to the meat of the matter, however. "It seems like a silly contest, fetching a pipe," dismissed Mavone. "Not at all," Sarakim insisted, sipping the sweet wine he preferred, "for Master Minelan has made the course as challenging as he could without being impossible."
"And what challenges are these?"
he asked tolerantly. I smiled. We'd spent several days thinking through the trial and casting the necessary enchantments. I'd gotten many of them to help, according to their specialties. Sarakim had not contributed directly, but had been delighted with the scope and nature of the contest, and had been an enthusiastic wagerer on the outcome. Bannermore had a list of all of the participants, and the coin brethren of Ifnia had not hesitated to figure odds and take bets. I wasn't betting, of course. That would have been a conflict of interest. But Sarakim was sure his foreknowledge of the course gave him a better handicap than others, and he had wagered accordingly. "Before they even arrive at the base of the mount," he told the Gilmoran war mage, "they must thread their way through one of Master Olmeg's nurseries he uses to supply the famed enchanted forest that caused so much havoc amongst his enemies during the recent difficulties. If that was not hazard enough, the river folk have been invited to pelt the contestants with stones, rotten vegetables, and ordure, but Master Olmeg is on hand to ensure that they do not hurt the little rat folk. Then they must cross the barrier of fortitude Master Minelan has laid at the base of the trail," he said dramatically.
"And the nature of the barrier?" asked Planus, curious. He hadn't been involved in that enchantment.
"A field of sigils that must be banished or crossed," I said, amused. "If one attempts to enter the trail by simply crossing them and bearing all of their enchantments, one would likely go mad. Coughing, vomiting, headache, sneezing fits, hiccups, vertigo, agoraphobia, paranoia, that sort of thing. None of them are lethal, unless some damn fool throws themselves over a cliff on purpose. But there are some nasty ones up there. You would have to be a decent mage to dispel them. Nothing a trained Imperial-style magi would have any problems with, but it keeps the sports and the weak-willed at the foot of the hill."
"A mere test of endurance," Mavone dismissed, unimpressed. "And then?"
"Then they must face the trail of trials," Sarakim continued eagerly, unfazed by Mavone's attitude. "There is all manner of enchantments along that route. Gouts of flame, unbearable noise, noxious vapors, binding spells, narrowing spells, illusions. It was breathtaking," he said admirably. Planus had helped with that part, and looked pleased at the praise. "Each element is triggered differently. A young woman might get a spray of water, an old man might receive a lot of noxious gases, though none should face more than four or five such spells along the way. Then things get interesting. They must face Master Minelan's apprentice, Sarondal, in a test of wits."
"I wasn't aware that apprentices had wits," quipped Planus. "Mine never do."
"Rondal is quite gifted academically and possesses a keen talent," I reported. "Nor did I desire the challenge to be too difficult, lest none would pass. But the test he devised is intriguing. He asks that the challenger remove the water in a chalice on one side of the meadow to a chalice on the opposite side, without touching it in any way. Rondal will not interfere, but he will call the participant out if they violate the terms of the challenge."
"That could be done any number of ways," Mavone observed with a good-natured sneer.
"Exactly why I like it as a challenge," I pointed out. "Rondal is there to observe and judge, but he won't try to stop them in any way unless they violate the rules. I want whoever gets the stone to be clever enough to figure out a way to do it. I don't much care how they do it, but such an elemental display of their talent and their aptitude with spell work will be telling."
"A point," Mavone agreed.
"And should they pass this test?"
"Then they face my veil,"
Pentandra said darkly. She had been the one I'd originally asked to place a special enchantment halfway up the hill as a way to discourage folks from dropping by the Alka Alon or their Karshak artisans casually. I had imposed upon her to make the enchantment permanent, too,
Unless one had one of a dozen snowflake-shaped pieces of snowstone she'd prepared, then any would-be interloper would have to contend with her veil. It was my way of making sure the Alka were not bothered by curious peasants.
It's a deeply psychological enchantment that forces the victim, so sorry, the participant, to face their darkest fear, she explained, or one of them, or something damn scary dredged from their deepest nightmare.
If they can manage to tame their own fear, then the veil falls, and they may pass.
That's sadistic,
Mavone nodded, pleased, but a good challenge.
And next, beyond Pentandra's veil lies the second landing, where Sir Tyndall awaits.
And what is his challenge?
Simple. They have to get past Sir Tyndall, I said. He's been instructed not to allow anyone to pass.
You think your apprentice can stop them? Planus asked, curious.
He's not a bad war mage,
Pentandra said quickly, and he's quite adept with spur-of-the-moment spells. He did some impressive work in Talri before Rondal and I picked him up. He took on 2 royal censors by himself.
She seemed as proud of him as if she were his mother, for some reason.
He's been instructed not to use lethal force, I reminded them. Soft attacks only. I don't want any funerals. It's good practice for him and a chance for the contestants to prove their skills. If they manage to get by him, the last leg is relatively uneventful. But then they come to the summit, and there they will see the pipe sitting on a conveniently located rock, and the bane warding spell I have surrounding it. If they can dispel that enchantment, then they get the pipe. I smiled to myself. It will not be an easy enchantment to dispel, I added. A bane warding is actually a class of spell designed to ward or protect something from casually walking off, like a lock or even a spell binding. A bane warding can be simple or sophisticated, depending on the power of the mage and the amount of time and energy poured into building the spell. We used them all the time at the academy, since our books and prized possessions had an almost magical way of walking off on their own in the presence of some of my classmates. At the lower end, a bane warding could merely inhibit the desire to pick something up, but the more layers and levels of focus you added, the greater the difficulty in breaking the enchantment, and the penalty invoked for doing so. This particular bane warding had 3 levels of sophistication, and was mired in thaumaturgical misdirection. Dispelling it would require understanding of at least 3 elemental disciplines, and the dynamics of arcane force. The spells were targeted at the higher functions of the human mind, the ability to reason and make sound judgments. The retributory feedback was severe, but not, I hoped, lethal. I had to be mindful not to make it too hard, to keep it fair, but whoever won the stone will have earned it. I was proud of that spell. It was the biggest piece of original magic I'd attempted in a while, and it was artful, a truly classy piece of spellcraft, not dependent upon the massive amount of energy I had access to through the sphere, but on thaumaturgical finesse. I had put a lot of careful work into hanging that spell. It had been months since I'd done anything creative or original, magically speaking, and I'd welcomed the opportunity to weave a really powerful bane warding.
Still, it seems a frivolous exercise,
Mavone said, shaking his head. To what purpose do you do this, Mage Lord?
As one of my officers, he was privy to the same daily mind-to-mind general dispatches from the field that I was. He had been languishing in Wenshar, cataloguing the censorate's holdings there almost as long as I had been in Sevendor. But the crisis in his homeland had compelled him to return to active service, and Telamon had recalled him to the front. He was anxious to return to battle. Despite his fastidious nature, Mavone was a war mage at heart. I thought about it. A fair question. The stone I'm offering is of but moderate power. I felt it important to diversify how the stones are dispensed, perhaps to establish a precedent. If a stone can be earned through a trial such as this, then there lies a hope for a mage to be risen to one through his skills, not who he knows or what his lineage is. Mavone looked at me thoughtfully. No, diplomatically. An important difference.
Of course, you must use your discretion in how the stones are deployed, he said finally.
Meaning you disagree with how I do it, I sighed.
As I expected.
With the threat in the west, he began.
I stopped him. Being the head of the arcane orders has its prerogatives. The other magi at the table grew tense. I am well aware of the growing urgency of the Gilmoran invasion, I said quietly. Indeed, it becomes more pressing on my mind with each passing day. Since I have been invested in Sevendor, I have taken the oaths of 26 war magi I have tested and found worthy. 5 of those stones I issued more than once as the wielders fell in battle. I am very aware of the dire need for yet more war magi. Then why this frivolity? Mavone asked intently, pointing toward the receding crowd of contestants headed for the mountain. His frustration was clear. Pentandra started to try to defend me, but I stopped her. This isn't frivolity, I explained. If witch stones are found only in the hands of war magi, that sets a dangerous precedent. As powerful in battle as they would be, the folk behind them would suffer from the lack of magic used in their service, and then the war effort would falter before it has begun. Magic, if it is to work in our favor during this war, will turn the tide, and that means it must be seen as a positive force throughout the duchy's kingdom, I amended. Understood, Mage Lord, Mavone continued respectfully as he sipped his wine. But what use are happy peasants if the Gravani are at their door, ready to eat their children and put them to the knife for the dead god's blessing? He sounded contemptuous. Part of that was his nature. Mavone is an aristocrat, and he sneers with every other word. But part of this was genuine anger. What use is victory in the field when all behind you lies in ruin? Asked Planus. Is that the perspective of most practical adepts? The war mage asked sternly. He was an Arasi war mage, down to the blondish beard and trousers and mage blade on his back. Planus, on the other hand, looked every inch an eastern practical adept, down to his silken robes and slippers, his thin goatee, and his plethora of rings and necklaces. He looked like a commercial mage, used to the sophisticated life of prosperous affluence. Planus shrugged, unintimidated by the Gilmoran. The people must eat, too, if they are to feed the army. The roads must be maintained if the army is to be supplied. The smithies need iron from the mines to forge weapons. The army needs wood for wagons and horses from farms. Every step a soldier marches is on the backs of 100 artisans and laborers. Deny them the power of magic, and reserve it only for the warriors, and resentment grows. Worse, what happens when the war is over? Bannermore asked, between messengers. Do the opinions of foot wizards now have bearing on the councils of the wise? Mavone asked, his scorn only nominally disguised. He was unfamiliar with Bannermore, and his growing importance to my domain, and he clearly resented a half-trained, unlicensed commoner having access to a witchstone. But Bannermore didn't take offense. He had been scorned as a foot wizard his entire professional life. He didn't take it personally. It's a fair question, my spell warden insisted. As a commoner and a foot wizard, I can admit that my talent is not adequate to merit a witchstone. If it wasn't for the grace of the gods, the spellmonger and snowstone, I'd be as meagre a mage as any wandering conjurer. But while I will not question my good fortune, I will speak for my class. I don't care if there are mage lords or not, whether there is a war or not. But I do not want the only ones armed with Irionite to be those who know only how to destroy. That's what happened in the Majocracy, especially in the early period of the late Majocracy, he said. I was surprised. Bannermore had found time to devote to studying history. He must not be busy enough. The balance of power within the arcane orders must not be absolute, Pentandra agreed. As it is, almost 2/3 of the stones in our control lie with the militant orders, the Horcan order, most of all. But if the balance of that sum is not held by civilian magi, then the future of magic in the kingdom will lie along military lines. Regardless of the outcome of the war, the result will be the domination of the orders by the militant orders, and perhaps eventual domination of the kingdom itself. I share many of your concerns, my friend, Master Cormoran said, gently placing a hand on the Gilmoran's arm. I was at Tudri and Timberwatch. I know the urgency of the need as well as the scope of the problem. But I'm also an enchanter, and without Irionite my craft would be all but fallow. Do you not understand the might with which I can now imbue a blade, and I am but at the beginning of my understanding of the nature of magic and enchantment. I am building great blades at my forge right now. In a year, I will be able to cast them aside as essays in my craft, compared to the powerful weapons I can build with a witchstone's aid. And look what Olmeg has done for Sevendor, I pointed out. A year ago this was a depopulated, deficient country on the brink of starvation and penury. Now the people get 5 times the yield or more they did without magic's aid, and my coffers are bursting with tribute. All right, that may have been a slight exaggeration. The fair had taken a lot of cash to initiate, but my yeomen were making my tribute quotas with room to spare. Far be it from me to take issue with how the spellmonger wishes to dispense witchstones to burghers and gardeners, Mavone said more heartily. But if Barrow Bell falls, and the rest of Gilmora with it, then all the magic gardeners in the world won't keep the dead god at bay, he prophesied. If the stone of one gardener or one burgher is enough to tip the balance in that struggle, Bannermore said quietly, then we are likely already lost. We are neither lost nor are we in danger of falling, I insisted. Would we have our new alliance with the Alka'alon if I had not done as I have, I asked, invoking the masters of magic on Kalador. Would we have the support of our new monarch if I had not acted as I have? The future of magic and the outcome of the war are entwined, but they are not the same. Yet victory at one predicates the direction of the other, conceded Planus. While our estates are far from the front, we burghers and gardeners recognize the urgency of the hour. Those of us high magi who do not take up a blade still have a role to honorably serve in the effort according to our abilities. Do not deny us this opportunity to contribute, he said reasonably. Nor are all civilian magi helpless, reminded Cormoran. The tales of Master Dunsellan's Magelord, Dunsellan, now, victories over his neighbours are intriguing.
And instructive, agreed Pentandra, frowning. Unregulated magic benefits no one but the dead god. Neither do private wars and conquering magelords, she added, present company excepted.
Then put the man on the issue of dragons, Mavone said, exasperated but still polite. They harass our forces in the field and make a mockery of our fortifications. Since the attacks on our garrisons in Gilmora, the men have been loath to gather in great numbers. The dragons divide our forces by fear as much as dragonfire. I intend on doing just that, I agreed evenly. Another excellent reason why I have risen civilian magi. The best thaumaturges are civilians, as are the best enchanters. If we are to combat the dead god on every front, we will need studious inquiry by our finest minds. That's difficult to do from the front, I pointed out. Still, that doesn't explain this exercise, he said, gesturing toward Matten's helm in the distance. You send spellmongers and apprentices and hedge magi through a comic trial to fetch a pipe. How does that assist the war effort? The mage who wins the stone is still subject to the terms of a high mage, I reminded him. He must swear his oath to me, he must act at my direction, and he must serve the king upon request. More, it gives hope to all of those who lust for such power. If they have an opportunity to gain a stone of their own, unfettered by rank or riches, then they have the hope of power, and sometimes that hope is sufficient to quell that lust. And sometimes it isn't, Cormoran sighed. Have you heard of the magi who haunt the penumbra now in desperate search of Ilionite? They brave goblin patrols, our patrols, and the desolation of that dark land in the hope of slitting some shaman's throat while he sleeps and carrying away a prize of power. Azar caught and executed one a few weeks ago. That was disturbing news, and the sort of thing that didn't make it into regular dispatches. My old professional rival in Bovol, Master Garkescu, had succumbed to the allure of power and had taken his stone that way after I had stripped him of the one I'd bound by oath. He had taken the stone after killing a shaman in the sight of the dead god, and had taken service with him afterward. Now he was serving his new master as a mage lord in his own right, presiding over an estate of the soulless under the occupation of the Gavani. I could only imagine what a dozen more Garkescus could mean for the war. It made me shudder. I wasn't the only one. Surely only madmen would consider such a route, Planner said, looking a little pale. Surely our profession is well stocked with madmen, Comoran pointed out. The allure of power is great on a man's soul. Slitting a throat, or 50 throats, is a small price to pay for that power, according to some.
Which is why regulation is the key to keeping such abominations from occurring,
Pentandra agreed, forcefully.
And regulation can only come with organization. Organization from enforcement, and enforcement with power held in authority.
Words, words, words! Sarakim complained. Regulation, organization, authority. There is a war to be fought, my friends, and the gods have seen fit to put us in the heat of battle, and given us such magnificent weaponry. What more could heroes ask?
He asked with enthusiasm. We mostly ignored him. Sarakim said vainglorious crap like that all the time, but Penny took it as an opportunity to lecture.
There's more to this war than heroes dying bravely, she began. And while regulation and organization do not seem like important weapons, without them, we are a mob, desperately fighting for our lives, not a kingdom defending our frontiers from invasion. We overthrew the censorate with the establishment of that kingdom, but as much as we dislike them, the censorate fulfilled some essential roles in that organization. We must replace those elements quickly, or unregulated magic within the kingdom will be another war to fight.
That's why I want to establish my own enforcers, I agreed. Agents who can act in my name. Someone who can deal with the executive issues the censorate did. At least the really important ones.
Well,
Mavone said with a resigned sigh, I resolved to persuade you, but I also made a vow to defer to your wisdom even if I question it, Min. I cannot justly say that I would have done better in your position. You haven't abused your power yet. And you've loyally protected your people. More, when you could have chosen a handsome estate, which to retire to, you chose this place, he said charitably. But I feel compelled to bring such matters to your attention. And I have always encouraged you to speak your mind, I reminded him, you and all of the High Magi. As I've said, I'm making this up as I go along, and your insights are appreciated.
Well, this is an insight you will enjoy, he said,
placing a small wooden box on the table. While going through the censorate's catacombs at their citadel, I came across these.
Witch stones.
Bits of Irionite confiscated over the centuries and stored in Wenshar. The censors were so paranoid about it being stolen, they didn't even have it inventoried. They were listed as stones of unknown origin and potency, and given a catalogue number. But there are 5 witch stones in there, none particularly strong, but none with an affinity to the dead god. 5 new High Magi for you to invest.
See?
Pentandra said encouragingly. If we reserve the weaker stones for the smaller orders, then everyone benefits. Even the weakest witch stone makes the weakest mage stronger than the strongest mage with no witch stone, Sarakim pointed out helpfully. But in combat one wants as much power as one can bear, Master Comoran observed thoughtfully. In enchantment, rarely is such power necessary. And, as provisional head of the Order of Enchanters, I would not discourage more witch stones in our hands. That brought a chuckle to everyone. But that's not the only thing I found in their vaults, Mavone continued, taking another parcel out of the bag next to him. The censors were diligent about collecting artifacts from the Magocracy, and there was a fine collection of old war wands in stock. Some of them are merely powerful. Some are unique. Some I've never seen before, but would be intriguing to explore. I give them to your care, Spellmonger, he said, pushing the bundle of magical sticks toward me. Perhaps we can resurrect some of these old workings and put them to use in the field. Or in the garden, he joked. And there were these, he added, placing a smaller parcel on the table. These are believed to be artifacts dating from the first Magocracy, from Perwin itself. I have no idea what even half of them do, and some don't seem magical at all. But the censorate was quite adamant about how they were locked up, so I can only assume that they are important. I'll leave it for the thaumaturges to cipher out why. I took that bundle almost as gratefully. I had a growing collection of such items in my lab,
and eventually I would get around to investigating them when I had time. Say when Menalion was having children of his own.
The first Machocracy?
Penny asked. I couldn't help but notice how Planus perked up too. Imperials are almost compulsive about their illustrious history, and anything that reminded them of past glories was of immediate interest.
When? What period? Min, open it up, open it up,
she said excitedly. Later, I said soothingly. I knew at once what had intrigued her. The possibility these artifacts may have to do with the Forsaken, the beings the Order of the Secret Tower were trying to protect, or, conversely, protect us from. We have time to do it properly. Right now, let's turn our attention to the base of the peak. The contestants are arriving, if you'd like to use your mage sight to see, and the river folk are happily pelting them with rotten vegetables. If you look closely, you can see the very first of them struggling with the barrier. Yes? I asked sharply. I dislike being interrupted, but the young woman, girl, really, who had quietly approached my table was starting to lurk now, and it was distracting me. She couldn't have been more than 12 or 13, red hair and freckles, her shape barely deciding it was female. She wore a peasant's travel-stained woolen tunic and trousers, and a faded and much-patched mantle of mottled green. She was lingering on the edge of our conversation and managed to dodge 3 different messengers as they brought their news and requests to Bannermore. Yes, I repeated, a little sternly. The girl paled, then swallowed and marshalled her bravery.
I believe you wanted this, Mage Lord,
she said, holding out her hands. I hadn't remembered ordering anything, but then I'd been talking non-stop for almost 30 minutes now, and may well have requested something and forgotten about it. She opened her fingers and pushed the object toward me as we all stared at her, dumbfounded by what we saw.
Isn't this your pipe? Wasn't that what we were supposed to get from the mountain?
She asked uncertainly.
Sorry it took me so long.